Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Nate Silver, who accurately predicted the winner of 49 of 50 states in the 2008 election. His blog, 538.com, is on the New York Times website, and his articles also appear in the print edition of the New York Times. We will discuss the wildly fluctuating polls as the election enters the home stretch, and his new book, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. Then Joan Walsh joins us. She is editor-at-large for Salon.com and an MSNBC political analyst and the author of a new book, What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. We will discuss the gender gap in our politics and what pits Americans against each other as the middle class shrinks, working families struggle, and everyone falls behind except the wealthy. And joining us in the studio is Nate Silver, a statistician, analyst, journalist, and writer. He runs the website 538.com, and his blog, 538.blogs.newyorktimes.com, is on the New York Times website, and his articles also appear in the print edition of the New York Times. He accurately predicted the winner of 49 of 50 states in the 2008 election, and in April of 2009, Time magazine named him one of the world's 100 most influential people. His latest book just out is The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. And it's a pleasure to have you, Nate. You're the man of the moment here because of the closing stretch of the of this long, laborious, and $6 billion
yes.
election. And just your latest piece in the New York Times from Wednesday suggests again that Ohio is not a must-win for Obama, and that the idea that it's always been a must-win state, that's been the conventional wisdom. You point out that actually in 2000, Florida was the must-win.
So it shifts a little bit from election to election, where in 2000 it was Florida. In 2008, the states that would have been decisive if the election had been closer, which of course it wasn't, were Colorado and Iowa, were closest to the national average. But this year it's Ohio with a capital O.
And the math at this point indicates what? That Obama still got an advantage over Romney?
Yeah. So if you look at the national polls, it shows a very close race. Some have Obama ahead, some have Romney ahead. But Obama's maintaining a lead of 2 or 3 points in Ohio, in Wisconsin, in Iowa, in Nevada, and those states would suffice. In fact, he can lose either Iowa or Nevada and still win the Electoral College. So that's how our elections are decided, and those polls have moved since the Denver debate, but they're stuck now, from Romney's point of view, still showing Obama leads in those states.
And of course, if it continues to be close, there is this bizarre scenario of 269 and 269,
yeah.
A tie, and it would seem odd that we have a system. First of all, the Electoral College is an anachronism, but because frankly, out here in California, you don't even know an election's going on.
Well, and I'm in New York, and it's the same thing really. Sometimes you get the commercials beaming in from Connecticut, where they have a competitive Senate race in New York, but there's no sense of an election taking place whatsoever.
Right. So there's no way to not have a tiebreak. I mean, it just happens that way, right? This is where the current Electoral College is.
Well, if you had an odd number instead of an even number of Electoral College votes, then you would avert this potential problem. And you could You could do that by adding another seat to the House of Representatives, for example. But you know, a lot of time in America and elsewhere, we don't deal with the problem until it becomes a crisis, and then we realize,
just like Florida 2000,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
And all those reforms have amounted to nothing.
Well, who knows?
And the Federal Election Commission is moribund.
Well, totally. You know, we have there are a number of states that have signed a compact that says that we will devote our electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote. Of course, you have to have a majority of states do that, right, before it became effective. But maybe if you had Obama win the Electoral College but lose the popular vote this time, which is more likely than the other outcome, then maybe you'd have some Republican states sign on and say, okay, well, we've seen this as an odd way to decide the election, and we know that's hurt us as well as helped us now in the recent past.
Right, but that initiative is actually gaining ground. It's a very simple solution, isn't it, that you just take the popular vote in each state and
So they all commit to it, right? There are some questions about whether it's constitutional proportional or not. But if you had two split outcomes in four elections, I think maybe that would motivate.
Right. Well, we've had some. Two. In 2004, we didn't have it, but it came close. And the Democrats feel that the 2004 election in Ohio was essentially stolen. But had Kerry won had he won Ohio in 2004, he would have been 2.4 million behind in the electoral.
Yeah, so that would have been a
popular vote.
That would have been a big split, a 2-point loss in the national popular vote, 2.5 points, in fact, right. And then him winning the electoral college. So it seems like a lot of it really boils down to the Midwest, frankly, where Democrats have enough strength in the Midwest that region is often decisive, and the other parts of the country can swing in different ways. But there are enough votes there to win or lose the election, particularly for a Democrat when you add up the votes in California and New York and so forth.
So obviously they're concentrating. Both candidates are concentrating on Ohio, and as your latest article in the New York Times points out, that it's really more of a must-win for Romney than there is a way that Obama could lose Ohio and still win, although it's
dicey for Obama, but not impossible. He would have to win any one of Virginia, Colorado, Florida, and those states are about tied. But you know, it's not a disaster for him, right? He'd have to win a state where he's tied now instead of the ones where he's ahead. Whereas conversely, for Romney, if he doesn't win Ohio, he has to win states that look even harder. Wisconsin, for example, is a competitive state, but Romney seems to be down 3 or 4 points in the polls there instead of two. It's a subtle distinction, but at this stage, where every little marginal advantage counts, then that's a harder lift, heavier lift for him. Or Nevada is a state that's started to behave more like a California. It's become more of a blue state. There's a lot of early voting there. Democrats are way ahead. That's not a state you want to have to bank on winning on election night
But Romney is, though. He's putting a lot of effort into it. And you know, you've got the Harry Reid ground game.
Yeah.
And he surprised everybody. And he, in fact, castigated the press in the last election.
That was one that we missed in 2010. We had it going for Engel slightly. But yeah, Nevada's also a state where it's a hard state to poll. The culture in Nevada is a bit different, where it's a very nocturnal kind of culture, not the rhythm that pollsters are used to, where they call you in daytime hours usually. You have a big Hispanic population. There's some evidence, by the way, that polls in California, in Nevada, in Arizona, other states are missing some of these Hispanic voters, and they tend to underestimate the Democratic vote in these West Coast, Southwest states.
Well, obviously, Nate, I want to talk about your new book, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. And again, Nate Silvers runs the website 538.com, and his blog is 538.blogs.newyorktimes.com, which is at the New York Times website. His articles also appear in the print edition of the New York Times. You've been running a lot of simulations, 40,000, about the Electoral College, but most of them break Obama's way, right?
That's right. So we have him winning about 70% of the time. And the reason why it's important to run that number of simulations, they only take about, you know, a microsecond each on a computer, is because you want to think about how the states behave in combination with one another. So, for example, if Obama wins Ohio, then it's unlikely that Romney would win Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is a similar state to Ohio, but a little bit more Democratic leaning. So thinking through all those many, many permutations that you might have, it does help to run through all those different potential scenarios. But still, at a very basic level, the state of the election right now is Obama's winning Ohio, not by a lot, but he's ahead by a couple of points there. And if he wins Ohio, he'll probably win the election.
So let's turn to your book, Nate Silver, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. So you're dealing with the world between probability and uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems we have as a culture, as a country, is that there's no consensus anymore about what is true.
Yeah.
Everybody's getting, yeah, you know, the Christians get their news from Christian Broadcasting, the liberals from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox. So you have to start from that premise that nobody even believes what's true. So what is true about what you do? Because you're talking about something that hasn't happened, which is the actual vote.
Well, see, here's the thing is I assert in the book that prediction is a way to test whether we're in touch with reality or not, right? We all have different ideas and theories and hypotheses, right? But if you're right, then you should be able to use that knowledge of the world to predict unknown events. And a lot of times people who are hard partisans are surprised and shocked on election day when the outcome doesn't go the way they want necessarily. With that said, this election's a difficult one to predict, so maybe I'll be one of the failed predictors soon enough. But I am talking, you know, when we issue the forecast, we look at it as a gambler might, for that matter, a weather forecaster, where we say there's a 70% chance of Obama winning, but a 30% chance for Romney, and that 30% chance will come up a lot. It's a very realistic scenario. So that's why I say, you know, I'm not the kind of person who goes up and says, this is definitely going to happen. Those kind of predictions sound great on TV or on the radio, I guess, but they're more prone to failure than the ones that are thought of in terms of uncertainties and probabilities.
So do you try to be governed by humility? Because when you mentioned weather forecast, I mean, yeah, every time we have a slight breeze in California, the weather forecasters go hysterical and talk about hurricanes and storm watch 2012, and they label it all and they get hyped up. So there's so much hype in this world. So is that what you try to govern yourself with?
I try and avoid the hype. And one thing that helps is that I have a program that I designed in 2008 that looks at every poll, and it does so in a way that's consistent, and it has a set of rules for how we evaluate that information instead of doing it in an ad hoc way. I mean, if I follow my Twitter feed or the news feeds I follow, right, every poll touches off some huge discussion and debate about, oh, was the methodology correct? And I'm trying to take more of a macro view, right?
Right.
Who's ahead? Yeah.
But do you have to, when you take that into account, are the polls biased? And as some suggest that, you know, Rasmussen, for example, leans Republican.
There are certainly some polling firms that have a Republican or a Democratic lean or bias. But what we do actually is we take that out. So if you have a polling firm, Rasmussen is one that is not that bad, but a little bit Republican leaning, maybe by a point or two, we just remove that. So if they say Romney's up 3 in a state, we say, well, on neutral terms, it's Romney being up 2 instead. And there are other firms that have a Democratic lean. So we defeat attempts, I guess, to bias the media narrative in that respect.
Again, I'm speaking with Nate Silver of 538.com. He blogs at the New York Times and also appears in the print edition, and is the author of the new book, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. So just in terms of a reality check, in terms of these turbulent polls that are all over the place and have been since the first debate, did the first debate, was that a game changer?
Oh, sure. I mean, the two most important events of this campaign have been the Democratic convention. I think maybe Bill Clinton's speech at the convention where Obama got about a 4-point bounce, and then the first debate in Denver where Romney got all back then and maybe then some on top of that as well. Those were the
two
things.
How many points would you say he picked up?
So Romney, we think at the peak of his convention bounce, or excuse me, his debate bounce, he had gained about 4 points, bring the race from a 4-point Obama lead roughly to a tie. Now, our model suggests that Obama has regained a point or so since then. He had a strong set of state polls, for example, today. He had some better national polls yesterday. So we think maybe Romney's peak has come and gone, but there's no doubt that there was a trajectory we were on before the debate where it looked like Obama might just kind of run away with this thing, right, and almost win by a 2008-type margin. There was reason to think the polls would tighten, and they did, but it had seemed – I mean, basically, if you look at the candidates who were up by 4 or 5 points in the polls on October 1st, as Obama was, they have a very good track record. They'll win about 80 or 90% of the time historically. And so Romney's odds were pretty daunting, and now they're shorter, although I think people are maybe slow to catch up to the fact that his momentum maybe peaked a week or two ago and he's not still gaining ground. He seems to have flattened out most recently.
So what explains the gap between likely voters and registered voters? Because it seems that Romney's been consistently ahead in likely voters, or at least there are more likely voters on the Republican side, which I imagine means they're more fired up. And I guess the big question here is Democratic turnout, right?
Yeah, so it's enthusiasm plus demographics, where Republican voters tend to be older and wealthier and whiter And all those things tend to correlate with voting at a higher rate, as well as with voting Republican. But there's also an enthusiasm issue. I think Mitt Romney energized a lot of Republicans finally with his performance in Denver. You also have energy from people who just want to get Obama out of office. I'm a little less convinced that Democrats aren't also somewhat fired up, but I think it might depend on kind of a state by state basis. One reason why you might have, for example, Obama doing better in the swing state polls than in the national polls is because they still have a very rich ground game, as we call it, where they knock on a lot of doors and do a lot of targeting of voters and place a lot of phone calls and run a lot of ads. So voters in the swing state might be dragged kicking and screaming to the polls by the campaign, whereas here in California, where I live in New York, you don't have that tug if you're a Democrat.
Right, but don't the Democrats have a lead in registered voters? I mean, it would seem to me that, you know, just as a cursory and trying to be objective about American politics, because I come from Australia where, by the way, you get fined if you don't vote.
Yeah.
And you have a much, much greater turnout. So so in your business, Australia would be easier to work with, I think.
Yeah, because sometimes it's harder to figure out will people vote than who they'll vote for.
Right.
There's little doubt that if every registered voter, not even every adult, just every registered voter turned out, then Obama would win this election. He'd be a 95% favorite.
So you have one party that has an advantage but doesn't necessarily win because it doesn't necessarily inspire its natural base. And then the other party that doesn't have an advantage but is basically always gets every last one of its voters out.
Yeah, this is kind of the yin and yang of American politics, where on the one hand, the Republican coalition is more narrowly drawn, but it's also, if it's more narrow, that also means it's more self-consistent, where Republicans agree with one another on most things, whereas with Democrats, it's more a matter of herding cats and having different interest groups. And so the coalition's larger, that's the reward, but it also means that some members of the coalition might not be as happy about where the party's headed at any given time.
So the curse of identity politics being
that's why basically over the long term each party wins elections half the time, despite the fact that Democrats do have an overall voter registration advantage. It's counterbalanced by the fact that it's easier to get Republicans to move in sequence with one another.
So back to your new book, Nate Silver, The Signal in the Noise: Why So Many Predictions Fail But Some Don't. Now, you're obviously very valuable to a lot of people. There are a lot of groupies out there that live and breathe this election.
And
a lot of my friends are so nervous, they didn't even want to watch these debates. They're so invested in this roller coaster that's going on. But they're obviously, you know, the world of predictions, and again, the world between probability and uncertainty, applies in business, it applies in business forecasting, and it particularly applies in the intelligence world.
Sure.
So how does your work relate, say, for example, to the intelligence world?
So we talk about September 11th in the book, and I interviewed Donald Rumsfeld as well as other experts on national security. And, you know, that's a case where we had different pieces of information that an attack like September 11th was possible, where you had caught Islamic radicals learning how to fly 747s on really flimsy pretenses. You had received warnings about a massive attack from al-Qaeda on the United States. You had detected plots to do similar things to the Eiffel Tower in Paris that were detected early on. So the pieces were there, but we tend to make the mistake of dismissing the unfamiliar for the unlikely. America has not been attacked very much in her history. Pearl Harbor, which still occurred not in the American mainland but in Hawaii, many, many miles away, that was very, very shocking to us. But for that reason, it was, I think, hard for us to contemplate an attack on American soil, and so we maybe didn't really take the threats as seriously as the evidence would demand. And that's a problem in a lot of cases where, you know, the events are kind of considered, I guess, black swans, to use Taleb's term. But really, they're more kind of the exception, more the norm than the exception, really, right? That the collective total of unexpected things, the collective total of improbable things, becomes more likely than you might think. That's kind of how a lot of news is generated, is something unexpected will happen tomorrow and that will grab the headline. But I think sometimes act more surprised than we should, which goes back to maybe not admitting how much uncertainty there really is in the world relative to our ability to understand it.
So how much is then connecting the dots of science, or how subjective is it?
I think our position is inherently subjective in the sense that it's a big, I mean, I believe in objective truth, right? But we are kind of imperfect vessels who only perceive some small part of it. There's so much information, so much data in the world today, we cannot possibly remember or process all of it. So we have to pick and choose what sphere of the world we look at and from what angle we look at it from. And that invariably leads to bias. It's unavoidable. But there are ways to become aware of what your perspective is and to become more objective, I think, and move toward that. But if you start out, I mean, you know, frankly, a lot of the reason why a lot of reporting on the campaign, I think, on the horse race coverage is in my view, quite poor is because reporters don't realize all the different biases that they might have. And I don't necessarily mean liberal bias or conservative bias, but in terms of wanting the race to be a horse race and wanting it to be close and what they mean when they say such and such candidate has momentum or how they frame different things in ways that are not terribly objective. You see around the debates, for example, you had a lot of people saying, well, you know, Romney won the third debate because he tied, right? I mean, that seems like a fairly clear case of bias. But it works the other way at other times, too, during the Libya attacks, right? Instead of the focus on the security failure, which would go to the White House, you had so much focus on Romney's response, right? And both those seemed kind of unweighted from what objective coverage would seek to tell people.
Well, I guess your job is not to follow the pack. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, you know, to the extent you have to pick being a contrarian or a follower, right? Neither one is ideal. You never want to be doing anything predictably, I suppose, but being a little bit of a contrarian is usually helpful. People are less independent-minded than they think they are, and especially in political coverage, there's a lot of kind of a pack mentality, I think.
Well, we've run out of time, Nate. I've enjoyed the conversation. I wish we had more time, but thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nate Silver, who is a statistician, analyst, journalist, and writer. He runs the website 538.com and his blog 538.com/blogs.nytimes.com is on the New York Times website, and his articles also appear in the print edition of the New York Times. He accurately predicted the winner of 49 of 50 states in the 2008 election, and in April of 2009, Time magazine named him one of the world's 100 most influential people. His latest book, just out, is The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll come back with MSNBC political analyst Joan Walsh talking about a new book, What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was.
You're like a roller coaster. Heavy metal dreams make a dead man scream. You're like a roller coaster.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joan Walsh, editor-at-large for Salon.com and an MSNBC political analyst. She's a regular on Hardball with Chris Matthews, The Ed Show, Politics Nation, and a range of other MSNBC shows. Her latest book just out is What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Walsh.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And I'd like just to touch on your latest piece at Salon about Frank Luntz. I was watching the third and final presidential debate and watching the MSNBC post-debate coverage, And the Republican, he was, I thought, was getting short shrift, Steve Schmidt, because everybody was sort of giddy about Obama's performance. So I switched to Fox, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Frank Luntz was conducting what was supposed to be a focus group of average citizens who had all voted for Obama in 2008. And it was so obvious that this was a hand-selected group of Republican ideologues pretending to have had buyer's remorse from having voted for Obama. There was just one token pro-Obama person in there to give it balance, but it was the phoniest, most cynical thing I've ever seen. I guess this is no news, right, that Fox is not a news channel. It's a propaganda channel, but one visit was enough, I'm afraid.
Well, I think people have been talking about this a lot, that, you know, there's a tendency in mainstream media to try to equate MSNBC and Fox, that MSNBC is a liberal Fox. But the night that you knew that that wasn't true was the night of the first debate, when everyone, to a person pretty much, with maybe one exception, was quite frankly horrified by the president's performance and called it for what it was. Everybody had a slightly different take on what was bad about it, but almost everyone was pretty down on it. And then you flipped over to Fox the other night, and they just act as though, for the most part, Romney won the debate, hands down. Frank Luntz runs that phony focus group. It's really astonishing. It's propaganda, not news, but I think it's one of the most damaging developments in our political landscape. I really think, as I write in the book, a lot of my relatives are conservative, and one thing that's changed over the years is that they have Fox, so that more than ever, they have a different set of facts, you know? Just one example, this horrible comment by Richard Murdoch, that the right-wing Indiana Senate candidate, that, you know, a woman should have her rapist's baby because it's God's will and God's gift. Somebody did an analysis. It's gotten 2 minutes of coverage on Fox and 2 hours on MSNBC in the last 2 days. It's not like it's the only thing MSNBC does, but, you know, they come back to it. 2 minutes of coverage. And they shut out all discordant voices, all discordant information, and they give their audience not just a worldview, but a set of facts and arguments that are kind of impermeable by anyone else.
So, Joan Walsh, today's New York Times is carrying a front page story suggesting that with this tremendous gender divide between the two parties, that both candidates still are trying to harvest, to use a Mitt Romney word, harvest undecided female voters. The disparity between men and women is quite stark. Romney enjoys a 14% lead amongst men, whereas Obama has an 8% lead amongst women. After the incident that you just mentioned now, assuming that some people saw it or most people saw it, to me, it was like suddenly we were back in, you know, the Witches of Salem. Here we had a genuine witch burner fulminating from the pulpit. Is there going to be a shift there? I mean, do you see any result of him and Aiken? I mean, hello, ladies.
Yeah, I think there was quite a result of Aiken. And Paul Ryan, you know, Paul Ryan's position about rape and abortion, he opposes abortion even in cases of rape, and that he has this quote that he said that, you know, the means of conception shouldn't change how we feel about life, basically. So if you're pro-life, as they call themselves, the means of conception, rape is just another means of conception, ladies. And so we saw the president's advantage with women climb after Aiken and after the Ryan choice. But, you know, it certainly narrowed in the last few weeks, and I don't think anybody completely knows what that's about. This is one of the few examples in history where a debate really seems to have made a difference, and I don't quite have an analysis as to exactly why it made such a difference. But I think that part of it is that, you know, Mitt Romney basically reversed himself on most of his extreme positions, and therefore people who were really just tuning in maybe for the first time saw a very different Mitt Romney. Now, the Richard Murdoch remarks are going to remind people of the real Mitt Romney. I think it's quite astonishing that he's not asking. He just cut an ad endorsing Murdoch, and he's not asking them to take it down. He hasn't. He's distanced himself a tiny, tiny bit, but you know, he's still happy to have his face running around the state of Indiana saying Richard Murdoch is the guy for the Senate. So I think, you know, Obama supporters are somewhat encouraged by that. And I do think that the momentum created by the first debate seems to have stopped and maybe reversed. But it's a tough time. I mean, not Fox isn't the only problem. I mean, the thing that I was struck by after this last debate on foreign policy, and, you know, I have problems with the president's foreign policy. That's an area where he's been more hawkish than I expected, and I think you could have a very interesting and important foreign policy debate. But what you had the other night was Mitt Romney reversing all of his neocon hawkish positions and saying, you know, I agree with the president. I would do what the president did. And the coverage, let's leave Fox aside, the mainstream media coverage was like, well, this is very savvy of Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney is, you know, blunting some of his rough edges because he knows the wars are unpopular now. And it's like, what? You're giving him political points for essentially lying and, you know, not expressing, I mean, there were some people who did, but, you know, for the most part, just really scoring it as a matter of political savvy rather than, wow, this man has no soul. We're talking about, you know, whether you send people to war, whether you bomb Iran, how you, you know, whether and how you stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons. These are, you know, perhaps the most momentous decisions a president makes, and we have no idea what this guy would do because he's told us both things. And I think the media just, they accept his craven lying and just score it on whether it works or not.
Again, I'm speaking with Joan Walsh, editor-at-large for Salon.com and an MSNBC political analyst. She's the author of the new book, What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. Now, obviously, the golden age that never was, in many ways, that was expressed in those atavistic, romantic comments by Ronald Reagan of the Shining City on the Hill, harking back to an era of black and white television with Ozzie and Harriet and the perfect nuclear family when blacks and Hispanics were invisible. And, of course, Reagan began his campaign for president in Mississippi. And prior to that, of course, Nixon came up with the Southern Strategy, which LBJ, when he signed the Civil Rights Act in 1965, lamented, well, the Democrats are losing the South. But frankly, they lost to Dixiecrats, to my mind. that was a healthy move. What's your historical analysis of that?
I think it was a necessary move and a healthy move. I think what was more problematic is that we remember the Southern strategy, but Nixon had a Northern strategy as well, and that's more of what I write about in my book because I really came from that working class Irish Catholic background where people had been, a lot of people, not everybody, some of my relatives had been, they were Republicans and they stayed Republicans. They didn't vote for John F. Kennedy. But for the most part, my family, you know, they were Kennedy Democrats. They were very excited by his presidency. And then some of them wound up going off and becoming Richard Nixon supporters. And Nixon's strategy was to play on the fears of the white working class about some things that were valid fears. You know, I think that those of us on the left sometimes forget that the 60s were not just a unbroken march of great victories and a triumph of, you know, good over evil, although there was a lot of that. Certainly the civil rights movement was crucial. But, you know, a lot of things seemed to unravel in the 60s, and that golden age, which we can get back to later, which was golden for a lot of people, actually, things came apart, and people wound up blaming Democrats. Some of that was racial. Some of it was a sense stoked by Richard Nixon and my friend from MSNBC, my former debate partner, Pat Buchanan, that, you know, your tax dollars are going to help those people, even though, you know, the expansion of welfare programs was really relatively minor, and the expansion that only went to African Americans or Latinos was negligible. But there was a real effort made to equate government with spending on black people and spending on unworthy poor people. And the thing that's so crazy is that the golden age that they all lament, and, you know, I was in Tampa, and you really felt that palpable nostalgia for this golden age. That golden age was created by government. You know, after the Depression and after World War II, there was a real decision made to grow a middle class that, for lots of reasons, fear of communism, fear of fascism, big business realizing that, hey, you know, more consumers could mean more money for us. Lots of things came together to get the government behind the cause of expanding, building and expanding a middle class.
So if, Joan Walsh, if Obama is to win this election, it may well be a watershed in the transition from it may be the twilight of the white man and the beginning of a kind of multicultural America, or the recognition of the political maturity of a multicultural America, which is, of course, bound to grow. So, but since this has been going on for some time, this and your the title of your book, What's the Matter with White People, has an echo of What's the Matter with Kansas, the notion that the liberals have always wrung their hands about why do working-class Americans, particularly males, vote apparently against their own interests. There has to be, a better explanation than certainly what I've heard so far. And there must be a deeper sense of betrayal that these people have about the Democrats as opposed to the Republicans to make that jump. You know, I understand the aspirational politics on the Republican side, but it seems like more like they're rejecting the Democrats than embracing the Republicans, because they feel perhaps that these are the people that should be helping them, and they simply don't believe they are.
Well, I think that's a really good point. And one of the things that I try to do in the book is you know, get beyond. We know, Ian, there's racism involved. We know there's a lot of racism, but it's not all racism. And I think that what happened in the 60s is, or after the 60s and in the 70s, is that, you know, you saw a new breed of Democrat really decide that success was going to lie in being more like Republicans. And you had a split between labor and the new left, and parts of the new left that became more about minority and women's participation were, with some good reason, extremely hostile toward the labor movement. The labor movement, you know, I wrote about this last week when George McGovern died. The labor movement helped destroy George McGovern. It wasn't just Richard Nixon. And so you had this falling out between labor interests, some of them, and you know, what was left of the new left, and you had Democrats moving away from supporting the rights of labor and moving away from being the party of the working person. And really, over the years, through the late 70s, through the 80s, the 90s, with the Democratic Leadership Council, you know, really trying to say, hey, we're the party of big business. We're the party of business. We're the party that can help business do better. Democrats became the party of Wall Street. You know, a lot of the inequity that we see, whether it was enabling the growth of the big banks or whether it was enabling Mitt Romney to pay, you know, far lower tax rate than your average teacher or firefighter, Democrats protected those tax rates. Democrats became the party of Wall Street. Barack Obama was the party of Wall Street in 2008. You know, he participated in cracking down with some regulations, but they weren't very strong. And you know, it's only now that the Justice Department is going after Bank of America for mortgage fraud. You know, so I think that there's a sense, the sense of abandonment that the white working class felt. Some of it was racial and racialized, but some of it was kind of valid.
But Joan Walsh, it seems to me that in Obama allowing himself to be rolled by Larry Summers, who insisted on cutting what Christine Romer wanted, which was a $1.2 trillion stimulus package, Summers whittled it down to $860 million, 40% of which was tax breaks, which was intended to court the Republicans who at the end didn't even vote for it. I don't understand that mentality that they're amongst Democrats. Why do they want to yield so much and end up hurting themselves? And it's just surreal. Because
well,
in other words, had we gone with the with Christine Romer's stimulus, we wouldn't be talking about this election being contested even.
Well, I don't know that there were ever the votes for Christine Romer's stimulus number, and I think she would say that herself. But if you had started out asking for that, have you ever negotiated for anything, Ian? You know, start out and say we want
right.
1.2
well,
trillion.
Well, I'm here in Hollywood. I got an idea of what you're talking about.
You know what I'm saying? Don't throw tax cuts in the beginning. You know, throw tax cuts in as a concession. Okay, we'll meet you in the middle and we'll make a third of the stimulus tax cuts. But Obama didn't do that. They never laid out the size of what they thought they needed. They didn't tell the American public, you know, we're in a deep hole and this is what it's going to take. And okay, we understand that we have to compromise. So maybe it still winds up being 900 trillion and maybe some of it, less of it is tax cuts. But you know, that there's a process where you tell people what we think the economy is going to need. You tell them why. You stand up and explain what Democrats did during the Great Depression, what Bill Clinton did. You explain the role of government in a time of economic contraction. But instead, Obama, you know, went around using that idiotic formulation that, well, everyone's got to tighten their belts, just like your family is cutting back on its budget. We've got to cut back on the federal budget. No, that's exactly wrong. And you went to Harvard, and you know that. But you're parroting what you have learned, what spineless Democrats have learned to say, and sort of basically colluding with Republicans in making Americans think the deficits are the biggest problem when they're not. So I think it was a real lack of courage about telling the truth about how bad things were and how much government was going to need to do to counteract those forces contracting the economy. It's not that he would have gotten it, but he would have started the argument and he probably would have gotten more. And instead, you were in this position of, hey, we're really proud. We just presided over the largest stimulus in history, and you had ridiculous promises that it's recovery summer, and we see the green shoots of the recovery, and all these, you know, promises of change, and unemployment went down, and then it started to climb again, and it got to 10%, and then we had the 2010 debacle, you know. So I think that Obama, the Democrats are so used to not telling the truth about what is really going to be required, and acting like they're in this furtive crouch where, you know, don't hit me, I'm a Democrat, I really think that we probably need to spend more to fix the economy, but I know you've told the American people that that's wrong, so they'll probably not vote for me. He had a mandate. He won with a larger share of the popular vote than any non-incumbent since Dwight Eisenhower, our first black president. You know, I just think I'm getting all worked up again. had he seized the moment that he had and the political momentum that he had, I do think that we would be having a very different conversation today.
Well, Joan, the odd thing is that it's exactly what happened in 1992 to 1994. Clinton had the trifecta. He had the White House, the Senate, and the House. And he was largely undermined by his own party, by the mandarins in the Senate, you know, the Sam Nunns and others who didn't really cooperate with him. And the same thing, Obama had, you know, he had the trifecta. And then 2 years later, there was this blowout engineered by Karl Rove. So it seems that the windows of opportunity are squandered. And I don't understand the mechanics of it, what it is about the Democrats, because clearly the American people are often pragmatic. They divide the government. And so when they give the government all to one party and nothing happens, I think they say, well, you know, sorry,
well,
guys.
That didn't work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are pragmatic. They're probably also impatient, but that's not my business, you know.
Right.
That's the way our democracy has developed. But, you know, I think there's also I think that both Obama and Clinton were undone by their own inexperience initially, but also by the power of what we now call the Blue Dog Democrats. I mean, a lot of Blue Dogs got defeated in 2010 because they were really, you know, running in purple or even red districts. And so you had conservative guys, mostly guys, there were a few women, who just weren't conservative enough. So they got taken out in 2010, no matter that they didn't vote for either the stimulus or for health care. They tried to be conservative, but it didn't work. But I think that, you know, when we say that both Clinton and Obama had all three houses, we really don't pay attention to the dynamic of the strong conservative forces within the Democratic Party that prevent progressive change from happening, you know, and there's not, you know, in the Republican Party, the dynamic is the opposite. It's that the people on the right prevent compromise, and the people, you know, so there's no Tea Party of the left, and so our whole political center of gravity has been pulled to the right by the existence and the power of the conservative Democrats and the ultra-right Republicans. We're just constantly hurtling to the right. So, you know, I think it may overestimate Obama's, quote, failure to say, well, he had all three houses because he just didn't have enough support for the things he wanted, the good things that he wanted to do from the conservatives in his party.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment with more of Joan Walsh.
Come out dawn too, hustling around Atlanta in the alligator shoe, getting drunk every weekend at the barbecue, and keeping the niggas down. We're rednecks, we're rednecks. We don't know our ass from a hole in the ground. We're rednecks, we're rednecks.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And Joan Walsh is with us here today. She's editor-at-large for Salon.com and an MSNBC political analyst and the author of What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. So the fact that the parties are compromised, it may have a lot to do with who owns them. Some cynics have said that, you know, the oligarchs own the Republicans outright, and they rent the Democrats. But the fact that there are the Democrats that essentially undermined Obama's efforts in that critical first couple of years, particularly when you had the one guy on the healthcare bill who comes out of the insurance business, who was one of the most obstinate of all of them, maybe that tells us something. But again, do you think that demographics are going to take care of a lot of what we're talking about? I mean, both of our daughters are millennials, and they are post-racial and post-sexual, if you will. They don't give a damn about anybody's sexual orientation, and they're completely colorblind. And it seems to me that much of what we're sort of wrangling over here are the remnants of a generation that you know, maybe going to take their problems to their graves.
I think that some of that is definitely true, and I am very optimistic about the millennials. But I think a couple things. I mean, part of why I wrote the book was that I felt that basically waiting around for, you know, an older white generation to die is both a little bit tragic because some of them are my relatives, but also I think there's enough time for people to do a lot of damage that could undo, that could leave a really nasty world for the millennials. So, I feel that clearly the Republican Party is on it's headed for demographic extinction. Right now, 90% of self-identified Republicans are white in a country that's 62% white. That's a problem for the party. That's a big problem for the country. I think if they lose this time, I think you'll have another round of bloodletting where the Tea Partiers say, well, Mitt Romney was a moderate and you never gave us the true crazy, you know, Rick Santorum figure. And so there'll be, you know, there'll be more fighting. But I think you'll also have figures in the Republican Party who will say, wow, you know, we really didn't need to write off the Latino vote. George Bush got a third of the Latino vote, or maybe 40% in his second term, I think. It was when the party got, when the rhetoric got so racist and exclusionist and extreme on immigration that Latinos had no place to go but to the Democratic Party. Asian Americans used to vote, it used to be very split, and in some, you know, some ethnicities that had come from communist countries in particular were Republicans. There was no, it was never preordained. You know, living in San Francisco, it was never a given that, that the rising political power of Asian Americans would wind up in the Democratic Party. And so I think you'll probably see, if not in the next cycle, in the next 10 years, Republicans realizing that they need to moderate some of their rhetoric and some of their policies when it comes to immigration and also just the way they talk about people. So, you know, I think that it's a little dangerous to completely write off the white working class or say that it's all racism and we just have to wait around for them to die off. I think we just need to be clearer about what, you know, as liberal Democrats, what we stand for, and that, you know, it's an inclusive multiracial vision of prosperity or greater security and greater justice for everybody. And sometimes that, and that includes, you know, the white working class too. I think some of our rhetoric, especially when we talk about, you know, a rising people of color coalition, there's a way in which that's coming and that's inevitable, but it also leaves out white people. And, you know, to me in California, the notion that, you know, quote, people of color all have more in common than they have in common with any white person is really silly if you know any people of color, you know, and you know the political tensions that we have intergroup and intergroup in California. That's not real. So, I think the next generation is going to do a better job with this, but also if we leave them with, you know, a continued huge disadvantage for African-American kids in particular, and high poverty rates and structural unemployment where, you know, black teen and young 20-something unemployment for young black men is in, you know, it's close to 40%. These things are not going to be solved by just, you know, better racial attitudes. I mean, we really have to be smarter about how we tackle all of this. And I really think going back to some of the Democratic ideals of a government that flattens inequality and a government that invests in people and a government that helps people understand where we all came from in terms of the government once creating a middle class and being able to do it again is part of the solution. It's not going to just be a magical people of color get together and the, you know, white conservatives die off and young whites are better than their parents, even though they probably are. My daughter certainly is. You know, I think that's magical thinking.
Well, Joan Walsh, I certainly don't want to join in the liberal elite in their contempt for white working class people who the Democrats have succeeded in losing and the Republicans have succeeded.
No,
but I'm saying that it's what I'm thinking more about is what happened to this party, the Grand Old Party, and you know, frankly, Richard Nixon would be kind of a liberal Democrat. In fact, he, you know, Teddy Kennedy regretted the fact that he didn't take him up on what would have been a single payer health care bill that would have gotten passed probably, but for Watergate. So it's the idea of this the Karl Roves, who was frankly the de facto head of the Republican Party, the oligarchs, the Karl Roves, and these atavistic people that are hanging on to a bygone era that I'm thinking are eventually going to fade into history. And you know, I would one would hope that the Republicans find their soul again, that they become the Lincoln Party of Lincoln, you know, not that I want a perpetuation of Tweedledum and Tweedledee, but I think it's just not good for America to have an unhealthy party that's taken over by crackpots.
No, it's not. It's not good for the country. It's not good for the Republicans. It's not good for the Democrats. And And you're right. I mean, I'm not sure what they could evolve into, but even, you know, the Republican Party of my youth, which was, you know, for somewhat lower taxes and somewhat less government regulation, you know, we could stand to, we could contend with that party. You know, the ironic or tragic, I don't know which it is, thing is that Democrats wound up endorsing so many Republican ideas, like, and even some decent ones, like, you know, the earned income tax credit was a Nixon, it was kind of a Milton Friedman Nixon idea. Gerald Ford signed it. It was their alternative to welfare. It was, hey, welfare mom or poor dad, go out and take a low wage job because work is good, and we're gonna, the government is going to cut your taxes to zero, and then even for some very low-wage people, we will give you a tax credit. You will get money back from the government to supplement your wages. This was, I mean, in some ways, it's very conservative because it supports private business in paying, you know, crappy wages to people, but it was a compromise between liberals and conservatives that Bill Clinton wound up really expanding when he did welfare reform, and that George W. Bush was a big champion of it as well. But now they want, that's the program that contributes to the 47% that they hate, that don't pay taxes. That's why a lot of them, not all of them, some of them are senior citizens and some of them are the military, but the ones who are the working poor, the reason they don't pay taxes is a Republican idea. The individual mandate on health care, everything about Obamacare, Republican ideas hatched at the Heritage Foundation as an alternative to a government takeover, Medicare for all. The individual mandate was an idea that we should all take responsibility, that Republican idea that we should take responsibility for ourselves. On the environment, cap and trade and carbon tax, all that, all those ideas were market-based ideas. I remember when, you know, leftist environmentalists were just horrified at that idea because it did come from the Republican Party. But we would give our eye teeth to be able to start with that now. They've run away from these ideas once Democrats, you know, said, okay, we'll compromise. Let's try that. And then they're like, we're going to go farther to the right. We're going to head toward feudalism. You know, it's really like workers should have no rights, and people should, if you weren't born into the elite, you should work from cradle to grave. I know I'm sounding shrill and hysterical
I think you're describing
like
a plantation economy, which, after all, one of the richest men in America, Warren Buffett, warned us that that's what we're heading towards. I thank you for joining us, Joan Walsh. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Great conversation, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Joan Walsh, who's editor-at-large for Salon.com and an MSNBC political analyst. She's a regular on Hardball with Chris Matthews, The Ed Show, Politics Nation, and a range of other MSNBC shows. Her latest book just out is What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments, and the conversation continues online at facebook.com/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time was